Welcome to Chit Chat Money. Today is Tuesday, July 20th. Today we have an interview with Massimo Marinelli. Kind of a unique interview for what we traditionally do. So it's less about public market equities. Massimo is an executive board member for Acer Ventures, which is, I believe, it's an investment firm in London. I think they're headquartered there. And they own Leeds United. So if you're interested in soccer, that might interest you. I think they're also a part owner of the 49ers. So we talk about that. What were your favorite parts about the interview?
I was trying to prime for information about Formula One because I know that investing in that, people get excited about that as well.
Because he did, I believe, well, was it?
It was in a prior life.
Yeah, in his investment banking, I think he talks about this. He did some transactions or helped in some transactions for them.
Yeah, I mean, I was just interested on how they formulate the deals with the soccer clubs and how that works in relationship to the owners and the general managers and stuff like that. Well, they are the owners, but like say there's a controlling shareholder or something, right. How they have to negotiate with them. It's all a bit complicated, and it is a bit of a black box. He can't share everything.
Right.
But I know people are interested in that, so learned a lot about the sports investing landscape, which is a really unique industry.
Yep, and then we have our show notes on the back and some acquisitions, some mergers, some deals to talk about, so we'll get into those. But before we get to that...
Well, we don't want to give a teaser, a little teaser.
Oh, okay. What are you talking about?
UMG deal was squashed.
Universal Music Group.
So Universal Music Group got SPAC-man'd or whatever they're trying to say.
Got SPAC'd.
Yeah, I know,
spacked.
But...
SPAC'd.
People
whatever.
Got... Yeah, but it's Bill Ackman, so they're like... The deal got whatever. But then Square is also apparently trying to get into a Bitcoin DeFi network. We're going to talk about that. Crypto, exciting as always. What about you?
I've got Zoom. They acquired Five9. It's kind of it's a bigger business than I thought it was. And it's a bit of a premium. So we'll talk about that. And then I also have a story from the Wall Street Journal talking about our favorite person, Adam Neumann with WeWork.
The cult of WeWork's good. I'm going to have to download it.
Yeah. And before we get to that, we got to talk about our friends, 7Investing.
I tweeted this weekend. I loved Matt and Dan's new write-ups. I learned a ton about two specific companies. Can't give them away, obviously, but I took the time to read their past write-ups. Those two companies specifically are kind of in our wheelhouse a bit, or something we can understand, but there's a lot of stuff else on there as well.
Dan's
is interesting.
Dan's picks are always right under your nose. Like you... Yeah. You know them, you just don't think about it. And usually that leads to good returns. So, feel free to sign up. It's code CCM. Go over there, look at their recs.
Get $10 off.
That's right. Without further ado, here's your interview.
Welcome to Chit Chat Money. On this show, hosts Ryan Henderson and Brett Schaefer interview industry experts and riff on the world of investing. As a quick reminder, Chit Chat Money is a CCM Media Group podcast. Ryan and Brett are also general partners at Arch Capital, and Arch Capital may have positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. Anything discussed on Chit Chat Money by Ryan or Brett or any other podcast guests is not formal advice or recommendation. Now please enjoy this episode.
All right, today we are welcomed by Massimo Marinelli. I believe I'm saying that right, pronouncing it right. He's an executive board member for Acer Ventures. This is a conversation where we're going to talk about sports investing, which is a conversation we really haven't had. But before we get into that, kind of background for you, Massimo, what interested you in the world of finance? Kind of give us some of the highlights of your career, and then what led you to Acer?
Sure. Thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be here. I've been in finance since I left college, basically. I started first as an intern with UBS over 20 years ago now. And I spent 15, 16 years in investment banking. I was an M&A banker focused on media, sports, and digital media. I did that between London and New York, and from there, after so many times, I did a lot of transactions in the sports. I did work. I led transactions for the likes of Formula One, MotoGP, Viacom, Sky. So lots of big corporates. But I also sold the previous business of the founders of Acer Ventures, And that's how I got involved with Ace Adventures, which is obviously an investor in a sports investing, as you just mentioned.
And I guess for anyone that's unfamiliar, what's sort of the Acer Ventures strategy? Who are you guys? And then are you guys focused on a certain asset class, or is anything fair game?
Look, I mean, we are a sports, media, and entertainment focused business.
Okay.
We definitely, you know, like those sectors, and that's what we focus on. We are, you know, we consider ourselves an investment platform that wants to, you know, bring together, you know, management expertise and capital. You know, we have some capital, it's the capital of the entrepreneur, which we invest, but we're also looking to diversify that with third party capital. And that's why in some of the investments that we have minority investors in it. Or in some cases, you know, we invest in other people's businesses. We're pretty stage agnostic. We're not a venture capital or a private equity firm from that perspective. Yeah. We don't necessarily have the criteria, you know, that a VC might have or that a PE might have. But we tend to focus very much on these sectors.
Now, is there any difficulty with, I know sports, sometimes, you know, there's certain people have ownership and they might not want to give up any rights. Is there any difficulty with getting these outside stakes? Because a lot of times these are kind of precious assets, at least with sports teams. Is it a lot different than, say, just taking a stake in a traditional business?
Dan, you know, it's a bit different, let's say, in Europe. In the US, obviously, there are a lot of restrictions, and sometimes, you know, you're not necessarily able to acquire easily a minority stake in a football club. Here, I wouldn't say that it's easy, but, you know, they tend to be more privately held company without, you know, sort of restrictions from the NFL, MLB, or criteria set by third party. There are, you know, some criteria that's particularly for the big clubs you need to respect. You know, you have a director's test that you have to go through in terms of, you know, being and obviously somebody that brings good capital in, you know, for example, things like that. But, you know, if you had the capital to acquire a football club and you are, you know, a credible party, you will be able to do so. In Europe, I think it's a bit easier from that perspective. The question is, you know, finding the right opportunity and having the capabilities to do it. Perhaps that's not as easy to come by.
Right.
Okay, and we'll get into what makes a good, you know, steward, I guess, of a sports club.
Yeah, and so I guess that leads into our next kind of segment, which is that you guys have an investment in Leeds United. So I guess what led you guys to that? And so what was sort of the thinking behind that deal?
Yeah, look, I mean, Andrea has always been in on and around football. So obviously it's a space that we knew a lot. His past, you know, he was a sports media rights executive. He built a very successful sports media rights agency. And by definition, you know, being football, you know, outside of the US, obviously the biggest sport, you know, was very focused on football. And when the business was sold, you know, it definitely started to look at potentially, you know, buying a football club. Initially, he looked in other countries in Europe, like Italy, France, Spain. And then, you know, he had I think he defined a chance encounter with Kenny Dalglish, who is, you know, very well-known personality in football here in England, obviously. And, you know, Kenny mentioned how Leeds United was a sleeping giant and a great opportunity, something that could come back to, you know, the former glory, and it was really an underutilized property. And I think that's what instigated the interest. You know, Andrea had a first meeting in first visit in, you know, the training ground in Thorpe Park, and really fell in love with the club. The club happened to be owned by another Italian soccer investor, football investor, and I guess the rest is history.
And I guess, have you always had sort of an interest in soccer, or is that more
football?
Football.
Well, look, I mean, as I'm sure you can hear, I'm Italian, so you know, obviously.
So it's been a good week.
It's a good week, yeah.
Yeah. Well, besides being a good week, you know, definitely, you know, it's you know, the home sport. So I think it's very difficult to find an Italian boy that doesn't like Italian. Not that I'm a boy anymore, but when I was a boy, I used to play football and, you know, follow football a lot. So
yeah, and what So from the financial side, what do you guys contribute to the football club? Andreas and the team, what are they doing? And then maybe if you could, how does this business work? I think a lot of listeners understand what sports teams are. I mean, those are pretty easy to understand. Everyone's fans of one, but how do they actually make money?
Yeah. Look, I mean, at the end of the day, you're hitting the nail in the head, right? Because at the end of the day, you're looking at a property that is a bit different from some of the other investments you might make. A sports club, you know, whether football or other sports, really has two very distinct areas. One is the sports side, you know, you have the team, how it performs, how you manage that team, how you make sure it's successful on the pitch. And on the other side, you have the business side, which is more, you know, how you can make sure you got the wherewithal, the means to support that sporting side. So from that perspective, you know, I definitely have a more familiarity and understanding of the business side and the football side. You know, there is a, you know, awful lot of things that, you know, even as a fan, you know, you don't really understand, or, well, you might think you do, but, you know, it's really, you know, different, you know. I certainly, you know, wouldn't be able to have a proper discussion with Victor Horta, the director of football of Leeds United. He probably, you know, immediately understand, you know, the difference between somebody that speaks business sports versus somebody that speaks, you know, football sports. I'd say that, you know, on our side, you know, as Acer itself, you know, we definitely, you know, trying to support them very much on the business side. So, you know, how you grow the commercial revenues, how you make sure that, you know, the numbers are under control, focus on the investments, etc. I think you mentioned, you know, how the revenue side works. And ultimately, you know, as I may have mentioned before, you know, I was very much focused on media when I was an investment banker. And in media, you know, we also used to cover sports. The reason for it is that one of the main reasons of revenues for sports properties are media rights. And so it was very much aligned to it. So when you look at the revenue base of a football club, you know, it's media rights that typically you might exploit through league deals. You then have events revenues, you know, ticketing. The further, obviously, you know, pre-COVID at least were able to, but from next season, you know, fingers crossed, we should be able to again, you know, have basically people in the stadium. And then you have other commercial type revenues, sponsorship and the likes. Those are, you know, the main three, you know, revenue streams of a football club.
As far as the like actual investment process, is it just one ownership group, or is the ownership of the team divided into a bunch of different investment, I guess?
Or just people?
Yeah, different people. Or does it kind of vary by club?
Yeah, look, it's different by club, I mean, for sure. In our case, you know, we closed the acquisitions as Acer. So Acer initially was 100% invested in Leeds United, but then we signed a partnership with the 49ers, or 49ers Enterprises, you know, obviously an entity associated with the family that controls the NFL team. And they now are minority shareholders in the club. They own 37% of the club, and we did that across two transactions.
Yeah, we're in Seattle, so we're kind of the rivals of the 49ers. But do we want to talk about that a bit at all, Ryan?
Let's do that on the, I guess, on after the break. But okay. I guess on the back end of that investment, I'm trying to think, like, how does someone that's investing in a sports team recoup their investment? Is there a cash payout? Like, do you get paid cash during the year, or is it only once you've sold that position?
Yeah, I mean, I think it tends to be more the latter. I mean, these tend to be assets that build a lot of equity value, and however you monetize over time. I would say historically, you haven't seen a lot of cash flow generation in club or cash flow yielding in Europe. But I think as part of the professionalization that you are seeing through the space, that will improve. It also, you know, it's down to the stage the club is at, right? Whether it's a club that is investing to get promoted, like we were two seasons ago, or whether it's a club that, you know, is obviously already reaped the benefits and is, you know, continuously winning. But generally speaking, you know, we definitely focus on building asset value rather than cash flow generation at this stage.
Okay. Does Acer treat, I guess, the Leeds investment like a passive investment, or is there more of a hands-on approach? I know you said Andrea is involved. So I guess, how do you balance that?
Well, I mean, Acer is very much an active investor. We are not just, you know, passengers on any of the investments that we make. In fact, we don't make investments unless we got something to add, really. And I think that's a key point in terms of our investment strategy, is about the fact that we are not just provider of capital, and we're not just an investor manager, with some expertise in a subsector. But Acer is comprised by people that have got real expertise in the sector, starting from Andrea and his past, as I mentioned, successful entrepreneur in sports media rights, and now obviously in broadcasting and football, but also other members of the management team, like Mark Watson, that used to run BT Sports and launched the BT television services. BT is the AT&T of Italy, United Kingdom, rather, to be clear. Or Graham Wallace, that used to be chief financial officer at Man City, and before that, long experiences in Viacom, just to name a few. So we really are a management team that brings capabilities to the investments that you make.
Okay, and then one more from the business side, what's a mistake someone can make in, that you don't have to give any examples or anything like that, but if someone's investing in a sports club, I guess a winning team solves everything, but what, from the business side, what's a mistake that some investor can make when, underwriting a investment in a sports team, and what could go wrong?
I think it's always easy to overestimate the commercial potential of a franchise in the short term. I think you need to be mindful that, if you have something that, you're just getting out of a bad moment or bad management or whatever, is not going to be able to suddenly, multiply revenues like that. It's possible over time, but it takes some time. So I guess it's how to manage that bridge between, being unsuccessful and being successful.
Okay, I think we're going to hit a quick break, but on the second half, we'll talk more about your guys' sports media assets. Okay, welcome back in. We want to hit on, because you guys have a few more assets and some of it's in sports and media. So I guess before we get into the specific properties that you guys have, how has the sports media landscape changed in your view amidst COVID, and then how have viewership habits been changing in general?
Yeah, definitely. There are a lot of changes in the sports media landscape that we had to really address and live with. The impact of COVID, I think, has been evident to everybody in terms of, sometimes the inability just of having games going on, which was clearly, pretty massive impact. But I think what it has done, it has accelerated some trends in terms of making people more comfortable with, the ability to just rely on mobile phones and perhaps, more video calls and things like that. And I think that has also had an impact on how people will want to consume media and utilize technology for that. So, for example, that's the reason why we launched last year Live Now, which is a pay-per-view business focused on live events, which were clearly not available to enjoy, live in, if it was a concert in an arena or whatever. But, we produced concerts and made them available online. And also, we think it's a good innovative solution in terms of allowing people to just buy events on the spot, on the go, perhaps from, in the future, social media, rather than subscribing to this or that, cable or cellular provider.
What happened to viewership? Did it boost during COVID? Did it increase with everyone locked in, or was it kind of flat?
No, the audiences were good. Obviously, we had the issue of not having games at times, so we had to navigate through that. But we were lucky enough, if I'm not mistaken, with 11 Sports to be one of the first broadcaster to have some live events. We had some baseball in Taiwan that came back. I think it was the first real, let's say, relatively major sports event that came back. And we start getting calls from every broadcaster in the world, basically, to, you know, get access to that content because everybody was craving some sort of live sports.
Interesting.
All right. And then what, I guess, you know, if my notes were right here, you guys either own or have a stake in the broadcaster 11 sports. That's at least in the United States, I assume it's like that in Europe and other places around the world as well. There's a ton of, I wouldn't call it uncertainty, but there's a lot of things up in the air of where a lot of the broadcasting rights are going to land. We've seen in the United States, at least, and I guess in Europe as well, you know, Amazon and other, mm-hmm. you know, platforms like that buying up rights. We had that for the NFL here. How do you guys look at that, and what's your strategy for the you know, eventual movement of all these broadcasting rights to, you know, online platforms?
So 11 is a business that was founded by Acer. Okay. So, you know, it was something that you know, was again born out of an idea of Andrea, given his expertise in the space. We are the majority shareholder, but we do have minority shareholders, you know, which are, you know, very, very reputable and big companies in the world of sports and media, and all recognized investors like Sapphire, the Sapphire Capital, which you might know, they're not far from you guys originally, or NBC via Comcast, or Liberty Global Ventures. Snap is a minority shareholder, or Liz Murdoch, you know, to name a few. So obviously, you know, we have built a business that has got some recognition now in real scale. You know, we got over $300 million of revenues for the year that just closed, pro forma for the acquisitions that we just closed. And I think the secret to have a successful business like that is to be more in control of your destiny, really. So, you know, you mentioned, yes, buying rights, but not just focus on the live rights. Is also, you know, what other sort of you know, propositions you can offer both to the fans and to the partners that you have, you know, the rights holders. So that's why, you know, we acquired and built new capabilities, whether it's with the acquisitions on MyCujo we did last year, now 11sports.com, or with Whistle, which is you know, the business that we originally invested in the US a few years ago, and as his adventures, and then was ultimately acquired by 11, because I think that allows to offer more original content that is attractive to younger demographics, as well as you know, additional services potentially to the rights holders.
Would there be, this is kind of a random question, but would there be any benefits to taking any of your assets public? I know it might be hard, I guess, with a sports team, although I've seen Man United, I think, is publicly traded.
Man U and, yeah, a few other
public, and a few out there for sure, yeah.
Would there be any benefits to that?
I think, you know, particularly with the SPAC craze that you guys, I'm sure, have debated in the past, you can imagine that, you know, there is definitely a lot of focus on sports, right, as well. I mean, that's also well known. There are, I think, you know, tens of SPACs folks on the space. So obviously, you know, we have to consider that as options. You know, it's also part of a job of an investor to look at every option. As part of it, you know, you're right, there is a lot more examples of people, sorry, of companies rather in the media and media sports space listed than clubs. I think, you know, it's definitely an area that we would need to consider. I mean, on the media side, I think it's easier to get comfortable with the diversification. On the sporting side, you know, you mentioned very, very big club. You know, I guess somebody also needs to consider how to build that that position as a one single club.
Right. And do you want to talk about the US operations? What all do you guys own as far as investments over here?
Yeah, obviously we are very active in the US, whether it's through our, you know, partnerships that I mentioned with the 49ers already, but also, you know, direct investments that we have made. In the past, I said, you know, we invest in this business called Team Whistle that was then bought by 11 Sports. So that was our first big investment in the US. But we also are an investor in a company called Sport Data Labs that is a software as a service proposition focusing on collecting human data from athletes
Oh, cool. Nice.
Yeah. So that's a, you know, not a business we're invested in. And also Live Now is very active in the United States. So definitely, you know, we unfortunately haven't been spending physically as much time as we would have liked in the US. We used to come very regularly, obviously with COVID. You know, I'm based in London, it's been a bit more difficult, but I hope that will change soon. But we definitely see the US as an important part of our investment and operations.
So with, you know, stuff in, I guess it's in any area, do you think the best way to, I don't know if it's just revenue maximization or just the ability to get the most from your avid watchers, do you think the best way to do that is to go after some, you know, niche subscription services, kind of like a lot of people have been going after? Or do you think just the ad supported model is better? Because it seems like there's a lot of avenues that you can go about it once a lot of these rights get debundled from, you know, the what I'm missing, the cable bundles.
I mean, at the end of the day, it's content and, you know, reach dependent in a sense, right? I mean, there are some content that can definitely work well with niche subscriptions and should definitely be pursued. I think it can also be always an additive strategy for content that might be big in certain countries or in certain areas, but not in others, because, you know, people are more mobile and there will be, you know, always somebody out there that might want to be willing to pay to get access to original content somewhere. And then on advertising versus pay, you know, obviously there are examples of successful businesses with both strategies. So it's about, you know, how you make sure that, you know, you have the right reach to either create the right base subscription model or generate the right advertising bundle. So I don't think it's a one size fits all.
And you said mobile viewership is growing a lot. How are you guys leveraging that within your assets? Is it, it sounds like Live Now has an app. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, Live Now has an app. Also 11 in the major markets obviously has an app, and, you know, make sure that people can use them as well as being available online. You know, in some markets, we only operate in Italy, and in Japan, we only operate over the top. So there are definitely reasons to make sure that, you know, you have to pursue that mobile strategy. And I think, you know, there is, again, some content that works better on mobile than other. But I guess overall with 5G and all the improvements in technology will continue to be an important component of our viewership.
Right. I guess one, this is switching a tiny bit, but you mentioned Formula One. I don't know if you followed it for the last or if you're a fan at all, but there's a lot of people, I guess, in the US now after the Netflix documentary that are fans of Formula One. I'm fans myself. How does that business work at all? If you can share that, and if not, we can go to another question.
How does it work? I mean,
like how does that business, how does the league work at all? I get, you know, you mentioned before that you did with Formula One.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, I did a lot of work with Formula One when it was under the ownership of CVC, the private equity firm. Since then, has been sold to Liberty Media. So obviously, it's new ownership. I haven't been as close to the business performance as it was, but the business, you know, it's a great business. You know, they definitely have a, you know, good setup with a league that controls, you know, the revenue streams and distributes them to the team by way of prize money. The revenue model is very similar to a club in a sense that, you know, there are obviously commercial revenues, ticketing revenues, in that case, media revenues, and also, you know, host revenues. So, you know, if you want to host a race, you also have to pay. You know, you could argue it's part of the match world in football you would call match day experience. You know, it's obviously a great sport. I'm pleased to hear that they managed to, you know, make additional inroads in the US, because definitely that was part of the strategy at the time when I was working with CVC.
Right. Yeah, it's funny watching everyone become Formula One fans.
I'm an expert now after watching 10 episodes. Yeah. But so if a team opens up, we can say, you don't have to answer this, but Acer, you know, they could be coming in, maybe making a little, I know there's only 10 teams and there's a limited supply, but that seems like one of the best sports assets, at least in the world.
Yes, yes, no, they've been definitely, you know, doing a great job with the Formula One. There is also, you know, some new sports focused on electric cars. So there is Formula E as well. Oh. That you know, there are races focused on cars that are more, you know, racing cars, but only electric. And recently there has also been a launch of Extreme E, which is more of a race between, you know, kind of let's say an SUV type car in a very remote location, again only electric. So, you know, with the move towards, you know, new technologies for engine motors, you know, it would be quite interesting to see how that develops. But, you know, Formula One cars, they already are hybrid, right? They're not, you know, as they used to be, just petrol cars, petrol engines.
What a...
It hasn't been for a long time. I mean, it's probably over 10 years now.
What impact do you think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Brett, but it sounds like they're putting like a budget across the league, sort of like a salary cap. Do you think that would benefit the league at large, or...
So there is no such thing as a salary cap in at the moment in you know, in the Premier League, which is where it plays. There are some restrictions in terms of financial fair play. So there are some restrictions in terms of how much money you can invest into the club, or you can lose, have a club lose. So basically, you know, it's sort of a element of controlling the fact that, you know, you can't just keep spending if you don't have the revenues to support that spending. So, you know, you can only lose a certain amount of money each year, let's say, controlled over a 3-year period. There have been, you know, noises in the past around salary caps. So, for example, I think the league below the Premier League in England considered that last year, but ultimately wasn't approved. Would it be a good change? Look, I mean, the key point here is that I think it's important to consider that clubs need to become sustainable. You know, that's for the good of everybody in sports. Nobody wants to see a club going bust. So hopefully, you know, that's going to be achieved somehow. Could a salary cap being a route for it? Maybe. But obviously it has to be looked at in the context of what else is being done to preserve, you know, competitiveness and ultimately, you know, an exciting competition, right?
Right. And I guess I have one last one kind of along those lines. So as the clubs, I guess I'm just assuming this, but you have a revenue share across, you know, all the clubs in the certain leagues. As investors or anyone on the business side, are you working with all the media rights? The media, or there are the people that broadcast stuff. So I guess, for example, if say you were the league was doing a negotiation in the United States with, you know, ESPN, NBC or whoever, are you working on that at all? Because I know that can have a big impact on annual revenues for clubs.
Yeah. So there are some rights that are centralized. And so it's the league that monetizes those for everybody. The most obvious ones are indeed the TV rights or the broadcasting rights. I say TV, but that's very old school. Obviously, they're also distributed over the top. But that's, I think, how still everybody calls them. And then there are some rights that instead are monetized club by club. So sure, sponsorship, it's another obvious example. So for us, you know, it's of course, you know, very much involvement on the ones that we can monetize individually for the club versus the ones that we monetize.
All right, that makes sense.
Oh, I have one last question too. Do you have any take on the European Super League?
Oh, that was
kind of relevant more a month ago, but what was the incentive there from the clubs? And then if I remember correctly, Leeds was the team that had the shirts on that I'm blanking on what it
yeah,
said.
But. Yeah. If you want, we can send you one, you know,
yeah. We're all game. We're game.
Exactly. You know, football is for the fans. That's exactly what we said. I mean, but that's indeed the point. I mean, I think the clubs that subscribe to it, they had in the press release that they felt that, you know, well, for a start, you know, they were obviously looking to get more cash in after COVID. You know, they had significant losses. And of course, you know, if you are a big club and you can't host 20 games through the season, you know, you're going to be more you know, you're going to lose more revenues than a small club, right? That has got five people going through the gates. I'm not talking about my club, our club. I'm just saying in general, right? Obviously, the bigger you are, the more revenues you lose from loss of ticketing. I'd say, you know, the overall structure, the overall thought process around that was really mind-blowingly badly executed, you know, and that's why it ended so quickly. It's definitely, you know, an area that I think people will need to just be mindful of. You don't want something like this to, you know, happen in that shape or form without being really discussed. I think, you know, there are great competitions already happening to the extent that people are looking at ways to make the sports industry more sustainable. Let's talk about it, right? I mean, as I was saying before, by any means, it's important that the sports sector remains more sustainable. But, you know, doing a private club, you know, probably, you know, wasn't well received by the fans. And ultimately, you know, without fans, there is no successful sports team.
And you said it was poorly executed. I think that was kind of the view from the rest of the world as well. What would you, or what do you think they should have done different in trying that strategy?
I mean, obviously we weren't part of it. So, you know, we definitely don't know all the things that they've done or they may have not done. But just looking at it from outside, I was, surprised that there was no clear management structure that was presented, you know, no spokesperson, you know, that was identified. So, you know, you kind of have few clubs speaking rather than one central representative. I guess, you know, it's difficult to mention, but I think most importantly, perhaps, was the lack of inclusion of the rest of the football world, right? I think it really looked like, you know, it was, you know, six clubs against, was it six, right? Or
yeah, six like or eight, yeah.
Six clubs against the rest of the world, right? So that was it, you know, probably not the way, you know, you expect what is still, you know, a sporting world to be the way you start something new, right? You probably want to make sure that, you know, there is obviously there are regulators, there are a lot of other players in the space, you know, even politicians, I guess, you know. It was quite surprising, I guess, the political reactions was also bad, and just wonder how did that happen? You know, if it was such a big project that has secured potentially funding from big banks and the likes, you know, how did they just, you know, not include the rest of, you know, this the rest of the stakeholders.
Right. Right. It seems like, especially with sports assets, yeah, taking care of your fans and I guess the other stakeholders are really important for building a durable franchise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. A wrap up question. We ask this to all our guests. What is one piece of advice you have for anyone that's considering a career? And I guess your background's kind of in finance, so anyone considering a career in finance?
I think it's very important to, you know, just first of all, you know, make sure that you look at why you might want to get a career in finance, and then, you know, just be very focused on securing an opportunity in it, because there are opportunities. Your first one might not be necessarily the one, you know, you were wanting, but, you know, at the end of the day, this is probably for a reason. You know, if you keep focused on it and you keep, you know, being very, you know, motivated, you can definitely make it. You know, it's a career that, it's, you know, obviously has a lot of entry points. So, you know, once you find the entry points, you just need to be focused on executing it properly.
All right. And I mean, that's all the questions we have. Where can any listeners find you if they want to follow you or anything like that? You on Twitter or?
I have, actually, you know, good question. I don't use Twitter that much, but LinkedIn is good, or, you know, that's probably the best platform. Yeah. I mean, I'm on Instagram, right, but I guess.
And it's Acer Ventures, if anyone wants to check it out. It's cool.
A-S-E-R.
A-S-E-R. The I mean, that website's cool. Checking out all the stuff you guys are a part of. So,
definitely. Yeah. Thank you, Massimo. Okay.
Thank you very much for your time. And it's been a pleasure to speak with you.
All right. Welcome back in. Thanks again to Massimo Marinelli for joining us. Next, we're going to talk about our stories for the week. And I'm going to kick things off. So Zoom acquired a company called Five9 this week, or they are acquiring them. And it's for $14.7 billion in an all-stock deal.
Have you heard of this company before? I have not.
I had seen it once. I don't think I've ever dug into what they did very much. I think it was during my summer at the Motley Fool that I came across them, but it was like on a screener. So didn't really do any digging, but the acquisition comes at a 13% premium to Five9's closing price on Friday. And it's the second biggest acquisition of the year for tech. I think the first one was Microsoft with Nuance Communications. I'll kind of talk about what they do and then I'll dig into some of the financials. So they are a B2B software as a service provider, mostly for enterprises, and they're providing customer contact solutions. So it's inbound, outbound, email. So you see the little chat box in the corner of some of the websites. They're kind of powering that. Automated voice, like contact center, if you know what I mean. So like when you call and it receives any inbounds, and it can kind of process them. It's helping enterprise companies.
Okay, so a little bit of a Twilio competitor. They're kind of stepping towards that market a bit.
I think they called themselves a customer contact as a service provider, nice. Which I didn't even know that was a market.
Nice.
But yeah, and they were, I guess, an $11 billion business before Zoom came in and acquired them. And the stockholders will receive 0.5533 shares of Zoom for every Five9 share they have. And Zoom's market cap, for reference, is just over $100 billion. So some of Five9's financials, they did just under $500 million in trailing 12-month revenue. It's growing at about 40% year over year. COVID helped them out a lot. And then 92% of their revenue is recurring. I think something like 80% is from enterprise, which is what they were hoping for. And then 121% dollar-based retention rate. Revenue retention rate, and then operating cash flow margins of like 15%. Free cash flow margins are about half that. And so Zoom is buying Five9 at roughly 30 times sales.
And they're growing at 40% year over year?
Look, I mean,
Here's the thing. Zoom is using their stock, which seems smart, right? So I was kind of like, okay, all stock deal, this is great. But if you're acquiring a company that's trading at 30 times sales, it feels kind of like a break even. You know, if someone's buying Zoom stock right now, they might be disappointed. But if you're a long-term shareholder, you know, you kind of got to like them using their stock price to their advantage.
So Eric Yan and the CEO of Five9 were both employees at Cisco in a prior life. Okay. So they may have known each other before. I'm reluctant to question anything Eric Yan does if it's cloud related, because I'm sure he knows the market better than me. And I also like him as an executive, but 30 times sales seems pretty steep.
It feels late cycle for sure.
Like cash flow margins have kind of stagnated over the last 3 years, and I guess revenue has grown. So
are you talking about for Five9?
Yeah. I mean, for reference, first of all, do you think the deal makes any sense? So Zoom trades, I ran some rough numbers, and Zoom trades at roughly 63 times trailing 12-month free cash flow. So I guess when you think about that as their valuation, using stock as currency is great. But as you said, it's kind of balances itself out when you acquire someone for 30 times sales.
You hope that you're using that expensive stock to acquire someone that's trading at, I don't know, 30 times cash flow or less or something like that, or even more depressed. Yeah. I don't know. How does this work into their business, though?
I don't know. I didn't think there's much opportunities for cross-selling.
There's probably a claim that, you know, it's probably in the write-up. So if you're an investor in Zoom, you can easily see what they're claiming. But I don't know. I mean, this makes sense for like Twilio, right? Twilio's kind of get into this, you know, but Zoom is more, maybe they have a whole plan here for like, okay, here's something that's coming to mind. What about like you're a business that subscribes to Zoom? You can also add on these features if you're a consumer-facing business, but I think that's a small part of Zoom's
market.
Zoom's
just not consumer it's like two different elements. Meant for like to interact with customers, and then one's meant for like internal communication. I don't know.
Yeah, the overlap of Zoom subscribers who would want Five9 at all seems low. right?
Well, I mean, Zoom subscribers applies to everyone.
That's what I'm saying. The overlap is pretty low. Like how many people or businesses even know consumers that use Zoom need it? And then there's probably only a few businesses, you know, I mean, it's not a few in like hundreds and maybe thousands of businesses that would want to use Five9 services that are also using Zoom.
I mean, the overlap is probably high because everyone uses Zoom. So I imagine most of Five9's customers also use Zoom.
Yeah. But
the chances for cross, I mean, I can't imagine there's that many Five9 customers that don't have their own, don't either have Zoom or
using some video chat,
Google Meet or whatever they are called now. I mean, at that point, everyone already has some video chat. So I don't know.
Well, all these.
Are we at peak Zoom? Michael Burry said it like 6 months ago. I think he timed that perfectly right.
With the stock price? Yeah. I mean, Zoom, I have no take on what Zoom's going to do. But the deals, what are the three deals that have been tossed around? There was, Slack got acquired by Salesforce. That was expensive. This one got what was it?
30 times sales?
Yeah, 30 times sales here. I don't know what Slack was. It was a little less than that, I think.
Nuance Communications, Microsoft?
Yeah, but that's big tech. They got so much cash flow to cover that. But there was another one. It could have been a Twilio. It's one of those ones that Twilio has been kind of a serial acquirer. The deal prices on these seem...
late cycle.
They seem... yeah, I don't know. They seem aggressive. You know, historically... a lot of times at the end of a cycle, and everyone says this, you can never predict what the end of a cycle is, but historically, when you look back, aggressive deals kind of signify the late stages of a bull market.
Let's tag in Mark Cuban here.
Yeah,
Yahoo acquisition.
All the contributors on anyone who works for CNBC now can thank themselves for the late acquisition deals of the tech bubble. But yeah, I don't know. This might not make sense to me, but I don't really understand these businesses all that well. People, you know, they don't well with them.
Let's get to your story.
Okay, so the UMG deal is squash again, like we mentioned at the start. That is Universal Music Group. So Pershing Square, Tontine Holdings, whatever it's called, Bill Ackman's SPAC was going to acquire UMG, but that deal was squashed by U.S. regulators. Ackman will instead take a direct stake from his hedge fund instead, about 5% or 10% of UMG, which is leaving the SPAC still searching for a deal. According to Ackman, the SEC raised a, quote, deal killer concerns with them last week, so the deal has to be stopped. These concerns could have been, this is kind of from an article I was reading, it could have been restriction on foreign securities, holders who are using margin, because there's some complications with the deal. We mentioned probably this at the time of the deal, it was the most insanely complicated deal. There was like 20 steps you had to read. I don't know how many people actually understand what was going on. And then there also was problems with people who could have owned call options because they were trying to roll over something with the SPAC. I don't know. It's all over my head. But now Pershing Square Tontine is apparently going to go forward with a straightforward SPAC deal, according to Ackman. IPO SPAC index, for reference, is down about 26% from the February peak. 26%, if you didn't hear that right. Is now the time, you think, to start digging a bit at these ruins, or what are your thoughts here?
Well, I am hesitant to buy it. Maybe it's just the risk aversion in me talking. But buying any pre-merger SPAC at a premium seems like a risky strategy, considering that it cannot go through. Unless you hedge it in a way.
There's a floor.
Yeah, but you are literally saying – I mean – let's say the merger opportunity is like 50 or 60% that it'll happen. You're essentially saying like, I will lose money if I'm wrong. Like if it doesn't go through.
No, I mean, you just don't get any returns because you just get the cash returned. I mean, there could be some.
But doesn't it go back down to $10 a share?
Yeah, if you're buying it. Yes.
That's why I say at a premium.
I didn't hear that. Yeah, assuming, if you're buying it above that $10 a share or whatever the baseline is, yeah.
I mean, there's probably a way to hedge that, but yeah. I don't. Why not just wait until post merger? I guess is what I would say.
There's got to be some. If things continue to fall, there's got to be some post merger opportunities here because if hundreds of companies are going to start merging over the next year or so, there's got to be at least a few out there that you can understand and like.
Yeah, I saw. I mean, there are some. It's kind of like a red or I guess a yellow flag for me. Companies that chose to go public via a SPAC,
and if they didn't need it.
Yeah, but there are definitely some gems. I'm guessing maybe 3% of the SPACs that have happened are going to be thriving businesses in the public markets.
Yeah. Or good. Yeah. I mean, stock returns, you know, more than 3% will be viable businesses, but the aggressive valuations. And if valuations were so aggressive, if the multiples were so aggressive, a 26% downtick isn't much, you know what I mean? On some of these that were trading at 100 times sales or whatever.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Yeah, that's all I have for that. Pretty quick.
Just wait until post-merger. Unless you have some hedging strategy, or if it's at a discount, maybe. But a pre-merger premium, you could definitely lose money.
That's true.
Because you're hinging it on a binary event.
Yeah, that is true.
All right. My next story, it's called The Wii That Didn't Work. So an article came out in the Wall Street Journal this Saturday talking about some of the fun stories of WeWork, our favorite company. And I think that – I believe the title of it was The Wii That Didn't Work. So I'm kind of stealing that from them.
There's infinite puns you can make in titles with WeWork. So that'll never end.
Yeah, and it's worth the read for anyone that has access to the journal. Their Saturday editions are always the best anyways. So just – if you're going to subscribe, maybe just go Saturday editions. But after they talked about some of the stuff between Masa-san and Adam Newman, so I'll dig into it. They said, after several early funding rounds, Masa-san and Adam Newman were apparently discussing a new deal that would include Masa-san writing a $20 billion check to the company. They'd already funded them with $4 billion. So this was, I believe, the biggest private funding round that would have happened ever. It would have been a majority stake in the company, I should hope. But if you've seen the documentary, the WeWork documentary on Hulu, you knew exactly how this money would have been spent. Plenty of music festivals and
a lot of alcohol.
Corporate bloat.
I think we said this before too, that the guy just needed to spend a few years at like a state school, and WeWork would have never happened.
Yeah, that's probably true. Like if he just got his partying out earlier. But there are some good quotes too. And then apparently as they were discussing it, Masa-san pulled out his iPad and started jotting down some notes. Here's a quote. He was jotting down notes on a picture of Yoda. And here's a quote from the article. It says, Mr. Sun, a risk-taking investor who likened his gut-based strategy of use the force to that of the bat-eared Star Wars Jedi, was visibly excited that his new disciple was pushing for such an ambitious plan. Masa-san then proceeded to do some quick back of the napkin math on top of his Yoda picture. And they have this picture, in the article.
Is it in the book? Was that from the book or is it just,
I'm not sure. I haven't read the book, but
it was the Wall Street Journal reporter wrote the book, which is why.
But anyway, he calculated that WeWork would be worth $10 trillion in a decade. So just, bringing out the pen, the iPad, a Yoda picture. I mean, this is what good underwriting is.
I mean, 10% of the real estate market or whatever it is. Yeah, it's easy. And that doesn't take any money to we all know the issues.
It just – like you got to go look at these notes because it was just like they had like 100 buildings or something like that. And he's like, I want 10,000 buildings.
Yeah.
And he's like 10K, 10K, 10K in everything. He's like, everything needs to be bigger. And then he's like, 10 trillion. That's what you guys could be worth.
I mean, it's a pretty scalable business model. It just takes a lot of money to do, right? You got to buy these buildings.
Yeah. And then, I mean, 14 months later, the company collapsed and Newman was removed. So
he just bought that house in Miami, though.
Yeah. No, 40. I mean, I'm sure he's doing fine.
Oh, he's doing great. He bought a palace in Miami. So things are looking up for that city.
I encourage everyone to go watch that documentary. Maybe read the book as well, it sounds like. I know I sound like a broken record here, but was this the greatest corporate collapse of the last 50 years?
So far. No, just joking. I don't know. Probably. Well, no. Enron. Definitely Enron. I think they had $100 billion market cap. And same with WorldCom, maybe. And Lehman. And they probably have bigger market caps. Yeah, but this is,
I mean, I guess biggest. Other than all right, Enron and WorldCom, I guess I believe they are frauds, but Lehman was more bad decisions wasn't smoke and mirrors. I guess maybe you could call I guess you could say
it's just those are corporate collapses. I don't know.
Could you ever invest in SoftBank? I know this is a value investor darling.
Yeah, a lot of people have been talking about it. I mean, it's trading at a huge discount to NAV, which would be like the net asset value, since a lot of it, SoftBank's a, we can't go over everything. We can't go over everything because there's so many different holdings. But if you add everything up and the value that they're trading at.
Who's calculating that NAV?
Yeah, well, sometimes other VCs writing up the investments in other rounds. I mean, they've had a lot of successes. Coupon, DD's kind of struggled out. Yeah.
What were some of their collapses?
I mean, they were in Greensill. But the thing is, they're in Cartera. It would collapse. But you got to expect that with the big risk. I mean, the WeWork stuff is definitely not great. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people that I think smart, rightly so. Oh. They're like, it's trading at a discount to NAV.
Okay.
Now, they might take risks, but that's not for me.
Value investor in you aside, you have someone jotting down $10 trillion on a Yoda picture and underwriting that.
Yeah, I mean,
he's still the CEO.
Management's not for me. Too much risk. Too much.
What is the net asset value worth if it can disappear tomorrow?
Yeah, well, you have to. I think a lot of people who invest in SoftBank would say that you have to expect greater returns for the risk you're taking. So you'd have to expect higher, like, you know what I mean?
He's obviously had some winners.
Yeah. So compared to other investments, maybe in your portfolio with safer, stabler business models, this would be something that you'd want higher returns on because you're taking that more risk, but I don't know. Maybe
it's a home run business for Masa.
Yeah. It seems like
there's not a lot of singles here.
Yeah. No singles whatsoever. I guess I'm just going to say it again. A lot of risk.
Okay. All right. What's your last story here?
Okay. Everyone loves, I bet. Yeah. No one really probably likes when we talk about cryptocurrencies, but I think this is interesting because it relates to public companies, and we can probably talk about how you can react or think about a public company that you might be invested in getting into cryptocurrencies, which is something that is increasingly happening. So Square, which is a company that, if you are a longtime listener of the show, you know that we used to own our personal accounts, but I just want to be clear here. It's not something we own currently, could own in the future, but just to be clear, we have no skin in the game here. This was everyone's favorite fintech company. They're getting more and more into cryptocurrencies from CEO Jack Dorsey. Square is, quote, focused on building an open developer platform with the sole goal of making it easy to create non-custodial, permissionless, and decentralized financial services. I'll caveat that with saying that Square they're a centralized entity, so I don't know. But apparently the new unit, which will be what people are calling a Bitcoin DeFi, I'll explain that a bit, but apparently the new unit will include the Seller, Cash App, and the recently acquired Tidal businesses. What is DeFi, you might be asking? It broadly means financial transactions that don't rely on centralized authorities like a bank, exchange, possibly exchange, but I don't know how you're doing this without some sort of exchange, or like a clearinghouse. Again, I get confused though, because you could argue that the software or whatever you're building it on is something centralized.
Nitpicky. It's decentralized with Dorsey in the middle.
I don't get when they say decentralized, because at some point something is centralized. Something is. That could be nitpicky, but I don't know. But okay, this also comes at the same time that Jackson Palmer, who created Dogecoin as a joke, I'm just saying that because he is someone who understands how these things work. You know, one of the few people, unlike us, that understands the nitty-gritty of a cryptocurrency. He had a tweet thread saying cryptocurrency is built, quote, to amplify the wealth of its proponents and evade taxes, quote, controlled by a powerful cartel of wealthy figures, and use a shady marketing to, quote, extract new money from the financially desperate and naive, plus a lot of other things. So the people in the, you know, whatever you think about that aside, speaking more broadly about any stock you might potentially own, how do you weigh the risks and potential when a company makes an investment in cryptocurrency?
I think this is wasted CapEx, investment.
Expenses.
I don't like it. I don't know. I guess, yeah, there is obviously upside, but if you have Here's, if you provide a service or a product that is core to your customers' lives, it doesn't matter what they pay in.
Yeah, well, okay, so no, I'm not talking about your opinion on cryptocurrency. So what if, say, you hold a company, a stock, and they announce, like Square is, that they're getting into Bitcoin and all that type of stuff, and you're a shareholder of that stock. As an investor, how do you evaluate that?
Yeah, I don't think they need to. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, but
it doesn't matter
control,
what the currency
is. Yeah, but
is.
You can't control that. How do you think about that for evaluating whether to buy or sell the stock?
Well, depending on the there's nuance, but depending on the size of the transaction, to me, it's a bit of a yellow flag.
Yeah, I think it adds uncertainty because it's something that, at least on our end, it's something we don't understand. You know, like if you don't understand that, that adds more risk, uncertainty. You might not know what's going well or not going well. You probably want to up your return expectations because it is adding more risk. I think that's probably a good way to go about it. And there's probably a threshold too where, if this company goes full on MicroStrategy, I mean, you got to get out. Like, you know, there's like a threshold where someone might be investing 2 to 3% of their money.
That's maybe the worst part is it starts small and then everyone says, well, if it works out, they're in good hands. And if it doesn't, they, you know, it was minuscule.
Yeah.
But that's the peak of the iceberg. They head down the rabbit hole. It happens to, I mean, go look at Michael Saylor. You start small.
I don't. It feels to them as like an addictive drug. Sometimes people get addicted to the cryptocurrency market and they can't stop. And it just, again, as someone who can't control what a company is doing, as an outside investor with not very much money, it just adds uncertainty.
Thing is, I know, we know plenty of people that own Square. We know plenty of people that own PayPal that are doing this. To me, it's a yellow flag, I guess. It's also like, let's say you are a software or services business that's asset light and you can potentially invest that cash at high rates of return. Why do you need to invest that cash in Bitcoin if you can get good rates of return elsewhere?
Yeah. No, yeah.
Your balance sheet doesn't need to be in it.
Yeah.
You provide a valuable service.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense to me.
I think the claim that this is just a customer acquisition tool is out the window now.
It's more than that for sure. I mean,
it may serve that purpose, but obviously he wants it to be a larger part of the business.
Yeah, and I've said it twice, I guess, but it adds the uncertainty where, just like with SoftBank, you're going to want to up your return expectations because it seems like the uncertainty with the downside is going up as well.
And the part that irritates me the most is as new information is presented, it's for Dorsey, it's always been like, how do I get this to fit my existing framework, my mental framework of understanding it? Like think about that. Remember when Musk tweeted the stuff about energy use? And then, which may have been just because China was about to crack down on it.
Yeah, coincidence. No, that was a coincidence, Ryan.
But, my concern is like, remember how they were like, well, let's have a conference and discuss this. We're going to have a Zoom meeting to try to convince you otherwise. It's like, just let people think independently.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing, but.
All right, I have no more stories.
Yeah, last one. I thought this would be a great way to wrap it up. Earnings season is upon us tomorrow. Netflix, or today, I guess, when you're listening to this, Netflix will report, which I think is kind of, at least for the tech bro circles that we kind of run in on Twitter or whatever in the investing
Netflix.
Community. Yeah, well, some people might call it Netflix, but Netflix is always the one that kicks it off because there's so many hot takes, whatever. And then there's the Delta variant news now, and that's hitting full volume. What are your feelings, thoughts heading into this earnings season? Should be a fun one overall, but anything specific?
No, I don't know. I mean, what kind of comps are coming up on here now?
Q2.
So that was full COVID, right?
Yeah, we're hitting full COVID comps, but then there's the summer, like slight reopen. Definitely going to be some comp, not really necessarily crimes, but people are going to look at comps probably with, you know, the headline numbers can make comps look weird right now.
I think there will be – remember how there was a lot of like – last year a lot of people were thinking like what's going to persist, like what's going to be an acceleration of a continued trend versus what's temporary. I think everything's going to feel like a continued trend. I don't think there's been a lot of – I mean maybe we'll get restaurant comps that are absolutely ridiculous, you know, because – I think for Q2 there's a large chunk where they just weren't open, right?
Yeah, not sure on that. Last year? That would make sense. Yeah, the only ones, it seems like consumer discretionary will probably do well. I mean, travel is going to do well. Apparel will probably do well. A little recovery. Mm-hmm. Restaurant will probably recover. But within the services. With Netflix?
I don't know. They've had worst library recently of content.
It's been pissing me off. Yeah, that's anecdotal, but I'll say I agree as well. It's been pretty piss poor.
I will also – I'll caveat that by saying I haven't churned yet, so congrats.
Yeah, no one – yeah, you always say that, but you never churn. But, yeah, with Netflix, it's always
– Disney Plus, Loki, crushed it. Well done.
Oh, really?
You know what? Marvel, I was a doubter to start.
Marvel's kind of, I don't know, I'm Marvel now. Aren't you too cool? I'm not too cool for Marvel. It's just a lot of hours. I mean, it's just
a lot. Which means a lot of content.
I guess, yeah. I mean, yeah.
A lot of them are rewatchable, but I guess I don't have any hot earnings takes.
There's going to be people that think it's the end of the world, like always, and there's going to be people.
Well, I really look forward to when, like, Netflix reports, and then everyone's like, what could Netflix earnings mean for everyone else?
Oh, that's the Motley Fool articles we're going to be writing.
No, but it's...
No, well, I hope things happen where companies you like have just a tiny miss, and then the stock drops 10%, gives you an opportunity to buy. That's what I look forward to potentially happening during earnings season. And I love with Netflix specifically, because it's either up or down 5%, because the algo is
always irrational.
If it's down 5%, the bears, which have been around for a long time, are like, see, we're right. And then the next quarter, they could be wrong again. It's like it's like a never-ending cycle with this Netflix thing especially.
All right, I think that's going to do it unless you have any more hot earnings takes.
Nope.
All right. Thank you, Massimo, for coming on the show. Thank you if you stuck around for our fun show notes. But that is going to do it. Feel free to contact us, chitchatmoneypodcast@gmail.com, or you can DM us if you're on Twitter. It's at chitchatmoney.
Links will be in the show notes if you need them.
That's right. And we are not financial advisors, so anything we say or discuss here on Chitchat Money is not formal advice or a recommendation. We are, however, general partners at RH Capital, so clients may have positions in the securities discussed on this podcast. Thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next time.